For much of the world, December is a month of cold and darkness. Long before Christmas became Christmas, a number of different cultures brought warmth and light into December with winter celebrations. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the history and evolution of Christmas. I'll talk with Bruce Forbes, author of Christmas, A Candid History, about how this holiday came to be and where some of our most beloved traditions originated. And during this busy time of year, many people voice a longing for a quiet, old-fashioned Christmas. Apparently, even the pioneers found Christmas to be a little stressful. I'll talk with Janet Claire Dennis of Living History Farms. Join the conversation after the news.
Six.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The hustle, bustle, and stress of the Christmas season can be overwhelming. People are often heard voicing their longing for a quiet, old-fashioned Christmas. Later this hour, we'll find out about those old-fashioned Christmases, and we'll also find that holiday stress is nothing new. But first, let's go back to the very beginning of this iconic holiday. Bruce Forbes is a professor of religious studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History, and most recently, America's Favorite Holidays, A Candid History. Hello, Bruce.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, let's go back before Christmas was called Christmas. These winter holidays were already something that people were celebrating. Tell me about the origins of those.
Yeah, I think that's very important. In fact, in studying the history of Christmas, this may have been the most surprising to me, is to really think about what this means. So I often say, for the moment, forget all about the baby Jesus in the manger. Think about winter and what that's like. And we know, don't we, if we live in the northern part of the northern hemisphere, it's cold and it's dark. I first thought a lot about this when I spent some time in Alaska, and people said, don't come here when the tourists do. Just imagine being here in December or January when there's 3.5 hours of daylight and it's 50 degrees below before you calculate wind chill. Now, doesn't it make sense that human beings living in the Northern Hemisphere would do something to try to survive winter? And I've got a great idea for that. Let's have a big blowout midwinter party. And what would that party be like? Well, you'd probably have the party right when the days stop getting shorter and start getting longer again.
Right at that darkest point.
Right, which would be winter solstice. And it would be a festival of lights to push back the darkness with candles and burning logs. It would probably have evergreens that look like they're still alive when everything else has died. It would probably even feature greenery that bears fruit in the middle of winter, like holly or mistletoe. You'd get together with other people so you're not isolated by winter. You'd feast, you'd dance, you'd do all kinds of things. I mean, you could just guess that's what human beings would do. And yes, that's exactly what all kinds of cultures did even before Jesus was born. So if you look in Northern Europe, we hear that term Yule, Y-U-L-E or J-U-L, that's not really a name for Christmas. It's a name for the pre-Christian winter celebrations that I understand. And in Roman culture, they had a Saturnalia, which is a real wild drinking party that was a little earlier in December, kind of a harvest festival. They also had a New Year's celebration that they called Calends, K-A-L-E-N-D-S, that's where we get the name calendar. And in the middle of that, there was the birthday of the sun god, warrior god Mithra or Mithras on December 25th. And so you've got all these celebrations, and all of them, they're predictable midwinter parties that I understand human beings would want to do. I mean, what I often say is, if I didn't live in a culture that already had a midwinter party, I'd make one up.
Well, it's a time when, if we think about the things that people had to do to survive before the Industrial Revolution, it was a time when people had a lot of time on their hands because they had put all of the supplies away for the winter months. They
exactly had
stocked the wood, and they were stuck inside a lot of the time just trying to keep warm.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you can see how, just as human need, this just makes a lot of sense. And so then later when Christianity, and notice all those things that I just described, that's a lot of what we think about as Christmas.
Right, a lot of the elements, the lights and the evergreens and the gatherings.
And so you can talk about all those. That doesn't really have to do with Jesus in the manger, but it has to do with something we need to do in the middle of winter. I get it. And that, and then Christianity comes along later and adds something on top of that.
Now, when did that happen? Because, you know, a lot of people this time of year, you'll hear different histories of Christianity. And a lot of people say, well, the birth of Jesus Christ probably did not occur on December 25th. So how did this confluence of celebration come together?
Right. Yeah. So, and yeah, you're right to bring up the fact that I hope this doesn't shock people, but probably Jesus was not born on December 25th. And, I mean, we really don't know. People have theories in the spring or November. But if you look at the biblical passages, it never says a month or a day. So, you know, I'm not arguing about what's said in the Bible. It just doesn't say. And this is one of my other big surprises, is that it takes about 300 years or so before Christians start celebrating the birth of Christ. So that I know now, it's all for Christians, it's Christmas and Easter. You know, even if people don't go to church at any other times of the year, they might go at those
times.
Well, for the earliest Christians, it was all Easter. It was all about the death and resurrection of Jesus, and that was the focus, especially in the time when they were a minority religion and sometimes persecuted. But it wasn't until the 300s or so, and this is after Romans stopped being persecuted, that finally they decide to have a what I'd say is a birthday party for Jesus. And I wish we were clearer about why that happened, because it would really be nice if there was some emperor or some pope had this document and said, in this year, we're going to start having a birthday party for Jesus for this reason. We have nothing like that, so we can only guess. And what a lot of people get, what we do know is when they have that party on December 25th, in the middle of all, like I just said, three already existing Roman midwinter parties, they had to know they were doing that. So why? I mean, maybe they wanted to hijack the popularity of those parties for the sake of Christianity. Maybe they thought the parties were too wild and they wanted to tame them down by giving it religious meaning. Maybe Constantine knew he'd lose all his troops if he told them they couldn't have their winter parties anymore. I think a symbolic reason is if you had the birthday of the sun god on December 25th. Well, you could have the birthday of God the Son. How do you like that? And there is talk about Jesus as the light of the world.
Right, right.
That would be a good time. But for whatever reason, the Christians started celebrating the birth of Jesus. And, you know, what that means is from the very first moment we started having that birthday party, it was already a fusion of a midwinter party and something of Christian meaning.
How long did it take for Christmas to catch on and become a big part of that midwinter party?
Well, I think quickly. I mean, I think for people, they just fused together. And I think this is why when people wrestle about, am I giving enough attention, if they're Christians, do I give enough attention to Jesus now? I think for a couple of thousand years, Christians have always wrestled with that. We've got a winter party and a celebration of Jesus together. We like both of them. How do we work out the balance? That's not a new thing. That's an old thing.
Right. So when people are saying, you know, put the Christ back in Christmas, it's kind of an interesting question of, you know, what are we hearkening back to?
Right. Yeah. Especially if you have, because I don't think people say this out loud, but when we have those campaigns, and I support them, but there's kind of an assumption that I wish we could go back to that pure spiritual holiday before we messed it up in recent years, whoever you want to blame. Well, what I'm saying is it never was the pure spiritual holiday. It was always a mixture. And I mean, there's one person who wrote a book. It's on a whole different subject, but I like the title. He said, "The Way We Never Were." So if you're dreaming of this pure spiritual holiday back then somewhere, if you could do that, that's something that hasn't been done yet.
So how was Christmas celebrated as it became more popular? You know, we know about the dancing and the gathering and the feasting and the evergreens and the candles and the fires.
Uh-huh.
But how was Christmas celebrated? Because it was not the kind of family celebration that we see today.
Right, right. If you look before, and we can get to this, like, let's say, the Victorian Christmas of the 1800s, it wasn't family celebrated. It was mostly adults doing things, which means there would be a special worship service on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And in fact, the way we get the term Christmas is it really means Christ's Mass. So it would be a time for adults, mostly adults, to go to worship and to gather in village taverns and drink and have parties or gather in homes. That it was an adult celebration, both religious and winter party. And it's only later that it becomes this family-centered celebration.
And when did that start to happen? Because it's hard to imagine celebrating Christmas without this emphasis on
yeah,
children.
Yeah. And in fact, to get to that, the one other really interesting bump is that it has to do with Puritans. Because the Puritans, the Puritan Revolution in England was in the 1600s. These were Calvinists who, after the Church of England broke away from the Catholic Church, the Puritans thought they didn't break enough away from the Catholic Church and they wanted to get rid of everything else, and they felt that Christmas was a Catholic thing. And I think their main objections were, they said, the earliest Christians didn't celebrate Christmas, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is they thought there was just too much wild partying.
It was too much fun.
And, you know, there's a statement about Puritans that I think H.L. Mencken said this, that the Puritan was someone with the haunting fear that someone somewhere was having a good time.
And it was impossible to ignore that people enjoy Christmas, right?
And that's probably unfair to the Puritans. But anyway, they kind of opposed it. And so it was discouraged in England and in the American colonies among certain groups in the 1700s. This is American beginnings. And in England. In fact, can I give you one example there? It just stuns me. There are a couple of folk historians who they heard that Christmas had declined in England. They decided they were going to read every December issue of the Times of London for a 45-year period at the end of the 1700s and the early 1800s, which would be more than a century after the Puritan Revolution.
Uh-huh.
And they read all those issues, and in the December issues, in half of them, there was never a mention of Christmas.
Hmm.
And in the others, it was just in passing. That's how far Christmas fell. And then, to get to your question, what happens is in the 1800s, Christmas.
You know what? Let's yeah. save that for right okay. after the break. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the history of Christmas. Bruce Forbes is here with us. He's a professor of religious studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History, and most recently, America's Favorite Holidays, A Candid History. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll also talk about how the pioneers and the settlers celebrated Christmas in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the history and the evolution of Christmas. With me, Bruce Forbes, a professor of religious studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History. And Bruce, just before the break, we were talking about how Christmas really kind of fell out of favor in the 17th and 18th centuries, and then it made a pretty amazing comeback. And of course, we did get to where we are today. But when did Christmas start to make that comeback?
Yeah, it made this roaring comeback in the 1800s and maybe became more popular than it was before. And I think it's oversimplified. Two major influences. One is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, and the other is Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, which is, you know, the Victorian Christmas. The Christmas Carol, we often think, I think when we hear that story today, we think that reflects what Christmas was like back then in England. No. Dickens is helping recreate or bring back Christmas, and he brings it back as a family-centered thing, right? The father of Tiny Tim wants to get off work. It ends with the family celebrating. Right. And it's also all about generosity and giving. surprisingly, not all that. I mean, there's not much talk in there about the baby Jesus in a manger. It's mostly about family and generosity. And then the other.
And that you're saying that really became a guide for people to celebrate Christmas in that way?
I think it adds. If I think of Christmas now, as a Christian, I think of Jesus. I also think of generosity and family together.
Right.
And those are added themes that I think Charles Dickens very much helped add to Christmas. And because there's nothing special, well, I guess the wise men bringing gifts to the manger of Jesus, but this giving generosity theme, I think, can be attributed more to Dickens. And the other is Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, who, even though they're royalty in England, they're of German background, so they hadn't been messed with by the Puritans, you know. And so they brought the German Christmas tree to England, and one of these most famous prints that published both in England and in America is of this, the family, Prince Albert, Queen Victoria, and the children and the governess standing around a Christmas tree. It just became very, very popular. Again, family-centered, which was true of the Victorian era, and more emphasis on generosity, which could mean helping the poor, but also could mean just flat-out gifts.
Right. I was just going to ask that. When did this idea of exchanging gifts with each other become a part of the celebration?
And I think that's when it starts, although it's still not as massive as it was today. If you look at the first Christmas tree, this famous print, it's a smaller tree and it's on a table. So I think as things grow after that and we get more and more presents, then we've got to move the Christmas tree down to the floor so we can have room for our mountains of presents.
Well, and you mentioned the Christmas tree coming from Germany. So was there a Christmas celebration that was traditional in Germany that became popular in England?
Yes. Well, at least the Christmas tree is part of it. I think, all over Europe, people were celebrating Christmas in the adult style that we talked about. And each of them had different holidays. And so it's as Christmas rolled through, I use this image of Christmas as like a snowball. I don't mean one that you throw, but one that you roll, like when you build a snowman or a fort.
Mm-hmm.
If you roll a snowball, you pick up things along the way, leaves and mittens that were lost. That's kind of what happens as Christmas rolls through Europe, is that they pick up aspects of their pre-Christian midwinter celebrations. So, I mean, you think of Scandinavian traditions or German traditions, and they get added and then they go to new cultures. That's how we get so many of them in the United States today. And if you do the Christmas tree, well, we've already said evergreens are part of it, but a tree is pretty much a German thing, a Christmas tree. And that custom then went to England, then came to the United States. That was part of the snowball rolling along.
Well, let's talk about St. Nicholas and figure out where he started to play in on all of this. And then in a few minutes, we're going to bring Janet Claire Dennis of Living History Farms into the conversation as well. We'll talk about how Christmas was celebrated here on the prairie over the years.
Wonderful, yes.
St. Nicholas, tell me a little bit about him and his journey to becoming Santa Claus.
Yeah, he's an interesting example of morphing. Because, yes, we start with a saint who from the 300s who we don't know much about except we're pretty sure he existed, but we don't know much else. But he was a bishop in Turkey in the 300s. And by the time we're done, when he morphs into Santa, that's an American thing. We morph him in this country. But St. Nicholas originally becomes a saint, and there are all kinds of miracle stories told about him. I don't know if we have time to tell those. But
give us an example at least.
The most famous one is he was the only child of a wealthy family, and he committed himself to give away all his wealth before he died. And the story is that he's walking through town and overhears a poor widowed father talking to his three daughters about in tears because he has no money to give a dowry. The girls probably won't be able to get married. They'll probably be sold into slavery or worse. And so St. Nicholas comes along later when everyone's sleeping and throws a bag of gold through a window that provides a dowry for one daughter. He does it a second night. Third night, the father catches him and thanks him and wants to tell everyone. And St. Nicholas says, no, don't. All the credit should go to God. And it's that kind of generosity, that kind of caring for children that starts these traditions. And before it spreads in Eastern Christianity and Western Christianity. So he's almost a guardian angel. I think more recently how people love guardian angels, that's kind of what he was. He comes over to the United States mainly through the Dutch.
Well, and yeah, let's talk about how he traveled into Europe, because, of course, I mean, you mentioned he was a bishop in Turkey.
Right.
So his how did he make it to Europe, and how was he seen there?
Yeah, that's it's interesting because Turkey would be in what ends up being the Eastern Church, which is like Eastern Orthodox. But his bones get stolen from Turkey and brought to Italy, where in a Bari, Italy, they had built a special building, and that became a tourist attraction, and then it got popular in Western Europe. And all kinds of churches all over Europe named for St. Nicholas. He's seen as a protector and also as a disciplinarian early on. The thing that we still have about the children, naughty or nice, that starts back in the Middle Ages.
Well, I'm sure parents caught on to that really quickly.
Yeah, there you go.
Parents know a good thing when they hear it.
The other important thing to say, though, is that his saint's day, a saint's day is not when a person's born, but when they died, was December 6th. So it was not exactly Christmas, but it was at least in that month, the period leading up to Christmas. And it's in the United States where we kind of move the celebration about him from earlier in December to Christmas Day itself.
We just wanted to push them all together.
Stuff. Yeah, all those gifts, there they come.
Well, and St. Nick's Day is still celebrated in the Netherlands, right, on December 6th?
Yeah, which if people think there's too much going on with gifts now, some people say we should follow them because they have the gift giving at another time, and so Christmas can have a different focus.
I can't be ready by December 6th.
I get it.
So
I'm a male. I do, you know, when we do our shopping.
We know. Yeah. We know. Not all, but many. All right. So obviously St. Nicholas, being a saint, there were miracles that he had performed in his life. But when was he sort of given credit for having these magic abilities? Obviously, he flies in a sleigh in the sky. When did this start to happen?
So he comes over to, as I said, it's really a New York story as well as an American story, because New York was New Amsterdam. That's the Dutch. And I don't know if we have time to do it all the morphing, but I outline in a chapter six stages. Some of the significant ones are that, and by the way, the Dutch called him Sinterklaas, which is St. Nicholas. You can hear that in there. So Sinterklaas, you can see, eventually is going to morph in terms of the pronunciation to Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the persons who helped start it is Washington Irving, who's the person who wrote Rip Van Winkle and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. He wrote a history of New York that was whimsical, and he told about St. Nicholas dressed in knickers instead of bishop's robes, flying through the air in a wagon pulled by a horse. And interestingly, he has one line where he talks about a finger aside his nose, which we'll recognize from later.
Right.
So anyway, Washington Irving helped start this change process. Then comes the poem that we all know, which is A Night Before Christmas. And it's true. It's the most famous poem in the English language. The way I prove that, when I'm talking to audiences, I'll say, 'twas the night before Christmas, and everybody in the audience can finish that line.
Right.
Right? Which is proof. But anyway, that poem, supposedly written by Clement Moore, although there's a debate about that, he is not, again, it's like Dickens. He's not telling us about the traditions. He's creating them. Because with one possible predecessor, he's the guy who gives us reindeer. He's the guy who helps move St. Nicholas to Christmas Day itself. He gives us coming down the chimney. So a lot of what we think about now, that's a further morphing. But it's still not our modern Santa Claus, because this is a big surprise. In the poem, he is an elf. So the children's picture books today with pictures of Santa Claus that you and I know what it looks like, that doesn't fit the wording of the poem. It says, the poem says he's a jolly old elf, but it also says a miniature sleigh, a tiny reindeer. All of this would help explain how he could come down a chimney.
But, right. And, well, and so And, okay, and, we
and,
have
and
this.
And he still doesn't look like the modern Santa. The first time an illustration was published with the poem, he really looks like a scruffy leprechaun. It would just strike you. It's nothing like what we picture now.
So, all right, and what year did Clement Moore?
This is in the early 1800s.
All right, and now, so that's where we get the idea of Santa Claus. But we also, there's Father Christmas, for example, in England. Did that come from our Santa Claus, or was that coming from Europe?
That's, yeah, it's kind of a different story, and that is when the Protestant Reformation breaks off from the Catholic Church, one of the things Protestants weren't so sure about was saints. And so a lot of the Protestants in different areas of Europe thought, well, we shouldn't have St. Nicholas anymore because we don't believe in saints. But they couldn't quite get rid of him because the culture liked this. So they had alternative characters. So Father Christmas and other names were kind of the attempts of Protestants to get rid of St. Nicholas, and they were never fully successful. So we just got substitutes. So it's not quite the American influence, but it's a similar story. Yeah.
So, of course, I mean, we all know Clement Moore's poem today, and Santa Claus is a big part of the Christmas celebration
right. All
over today. Did that just catch on like wildfire? I mean, it's such a beautiful story.
Oh, yeah. Can I say there are two, try to do this quick, there are two other influences. Thomas Nast was a political cartoonist who gave us the elephant and the donkey and Uncle Sam and so on. He started drawing a Santa more like we think of. And then, you know what really gave us this image of Santa? So if I say Santa Claus, I know what you think about in your head. It's 30 years of paintings by Haddon Sundblom as commercials for Coca-Cola.
Wow.
Coca-Cola Santa. Well, as I just said, if I say Santa Claus, I know what you picture.
Right.
And it's not that Coca-Cola started that, but they polished him and finished and froze him in time. So that's our image. And then, yeah, and I think it's magical for us because he is this gift giver, and he's now not a disciplinarian as much as he is a jolly uncle who's generous with us.
I'm talking with Bruce Forbes. He's professor of religious studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History. And Janet Claire Dennis is also with us. She's director of interpretation at Living History Farms. Hello, Janet.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, Bruce was just describing how the Santa Claus story became a story that we all knew and all loved and celebrated across the United States. And so when the settlers first started coming to Iowa, that was part of the story that they carried with them?
If you think of pioneers coming into Iowa in the 1840s, from overseas, they're bringing their ethnic traditions. And when you look at diaries of that time period, you see a lot of regret that they don't have those pieces that they were used to. We have a great story from Elizabeth Corrin up in Decorah. When she first arrives there, it's just before Christmas, and she talks about how strange it is not to have her family with her or the traditions that she was used to. So even if she couldn't celebrate in the same way, she's still talking about how she misses that Christmas.
Interesting. So because of the way that we are a melting pot in the United States, we were almost mirroring what Bruce was talking about as in the Victorian age when these traditions were coming from Europe into England. They were also coming from Europe into Iowa.
We do have some of those direct influences of people moving from Norway or from Germany directly into Iowa, bringing those, I suppose you could say, more pure traditions from a direct line. But you forget how quickly mass media reaches settlers in Iowa. So a lot of those in traditions that some of those early settlers are getting are the ones that have been filtered through Godey's Ladies' Book or through Harper's Weekly. As soon as trains hit Iowa, then all of those magazines and all of that influence starts to show up in Iowa. And that's where they get their image of Santa Claus. It's all from Thomas Nast.
And as, of course, these settlers are making their lives in Iowa, it's not very easy to have Santa Claus visit. What were some of the ways that families did celebrate? And what could Santa Claus bring to families on the prairies?
Stockings were often filled with donuts or penny candy. Anything that you could kind of carve away rag dolls and even strips of calico that could be made into dolls were acceptable presents for kids at Christmas.
And Bruce was talking about how during this time in Europe, it became a family holiday. By the time settlers were reaching Iowa, it was a family holiday already, do you think?
You see a little bit of both. In the newspapers in the 1840s, you see lots of listings of dances in eastern Iowa. If you think of Iowa City and Muscatine and Burlington, these are river cities that have been established for a while. So we have accounts of people getting in a sleigh and going into Iowa City to have a dance or fighting snow to get to somewhere to go to a party. So there are lots of adult examples of that. But then you also have the kids who are remembering that they woke up and there were nice brand new donuts in their stockings in the morning. So there's a little bit of a mix in the 1840s. As you get into the 1860s, then all of those other influences start to come in, and there's really community Christmas trees at schools.
And I want to talk about those in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. Janet Claire Dennis is here, Director of Interpretation at Living History Farms. Bruce Forbes, Professor of Religious Studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History, and we'll continue our conversation about the history and evolution of Christmas in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Okay, Alvin. Alvin.
Alvin!
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the history of Christmas. And with me, Bruce Forbes, Professor of Religious Studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History, and most recently, America's Favorite Holidays, A Candid History. Also with us, Janet Claire Dennis, Director of Interpretation at Living History Farms. And we'd love to hear from you as well. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Janet, just before the break, you were talking about Christmas trees. And of course, Bruce, earlier you had talked about how Christmas trees made it to England from Germany and made their way to the United States. But Janet, when Christmas trees first started in the United States, this wasn't something that you would put in your living room necessarily, right?
It's mostly for wealthy families to have their own tree. Most people experienced the Christmas tree in the 1850s and 60s in Iowa at their church or at their school or at their town hall community center. And to talk about some of the influence that people like Charles Dickens have or that Thomas Nast has, the Anamosa newspaper in the 1870s reported a church celebration where Santa Claus arrived to take presents off the tree to give away, and he actually had reindeer in the newspaper account. So those people knew what Santa was supposed to look like for those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And these community Christmas trees, I remember reading accounts in the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder, for example. I mean, what did they look like? They weren't exactly like the trees that we think of today.
Well, Iowa has an evergreen challenge because we only have certain native trees. So you're more likely to get cedar than you are Douglas fir in the 1870s. So they may be a little scruffy, more of a Charlie Brown tree to a modern eye. And then you also see little accounts of, oh, they did Christmas steps that were decorated with evergreen instead of a tree, or a Christmas ship. So there were some variations, but the decorations on them are often in the 1860s going to be homemade. And the presents themselves often become decorations for the tree. So dolls and toys and cornucopias full of nuts and popcorn are all going on the tree as part of that presentation rather than wrapping them separately.
And where were these presents coming from?
Well, there was a lot of encouragement for kids and women who didn't necessarily have a lot of their own disposable income to make presents for each other. But you see lots of ads in the newspapers where drugstores and general stores were pushing their holiday toys. That starts as early as the 1850s. We have a Dubuque account where a local merchant is saying they have gift books and gold and silver mounted card cases that are all available for Christmas presents. So a lot of it depends on your wealth and the disposable income that you had kind of tucked away for that Christmas holiday.
All right. So when Christmas started to become a boon for businesses and they started encouraging people to buy presents. Bruce, how long did it take people to say, hey, Christmas is too commercial?
Well, first, this is a great theme here because there is this shift from modest presents to homemade but more elaborate presents and then more and more purchased presents. And, yeah, a shift from only the wealthy purchasing presents to almost everyone starting to purchase them. And it's a gradual increase that goes all the way through the 1800s, all the way through the 1900s. And I think at first there's not a protest about too many purchased presents because purchasing meant it was special. It wasn't homemade. Isn't it an irony now that now that there are too many purchased presents, now what is special are homemade presents, the other direction?
That is interesting. And do we start to see, Janet, people complaining in the newspapers that Christmas is getting to be too commercial, that kind of thing?
One of the more popular farming magazines for the later 1800s is the American Agriculturalist. And in 1874, you see a ladies' column complaining that children are getting too much stuff. And they suggest that you give them a book that's going to help shape their mind. You want an industrious toy like blocks. And maybe a sweet treat, and that should be it, that they need just this much, and that there's just way too much stuff going to kids. So it's hard to tell whether that's really representative of a farming family, but that was already a complaint that was going out.
What, in the 1870s or when?
It was 1874.
1874, which that's hard to imagine what that person might think of Christmas today.
Well, and it's interesting to see the newspaper ads. Those merchants are already giving you that sales pitch that we are so used to today. One of the Iowa Des Moines newspapers in 1874 had an ad that said, Christmas is coming, and your wife, your daughters, your foes, and your friends will expect you to remember them. So they're already playing on that guilt of, hey, you have all these friends, and if you don't give them something, they're going to miss it.
And you were supposed to give presents to your enemies as well?
That hard sell doesn't start in 1950. It starts in the 1860s and 70s.
Oh, that's really interesting. I want to get to the phones here. Steve is on the line at Pleasant Hill at 866-780-9100. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. And you have a very old ornament that's been passed down in your family, right?
Yep, I do. My grandfather was born in 1900, and his parents were Czech immigrants up in northern Minnesota. And we still have an ornament of his. Basically what it is it's just a little metal candle holder with a counterweight that's painted, but it looks all handmade. The counterweight looks like a bright red cherry. But how the story goes is they would put all these ornaments on the Christmas tree, and then one of the kids was assigned the job of standing by the Christmas tree with a bucket of water, and they could only let the thing be lit for about 5 minutes because it was such a fire hazard. I look at it and it's a beautiful, we hang it up every year, but obviously we never light it because it's
a terrible fire hazard, right?
Yeah. So that's all I wanted to add. Thank you very
right.
much for
yeah,
the show.
Steve, thank you so much for sharing that. And was that something that we saw people doing in Iowa, putting candles on the tree, Janet?
Oh, absolutely. And that's when we do reconstructed trees for our Christmas event at Living History Farms. That's one of the most common questions is, would you really light all those candles? Well, yes, for about 5 minutes, enough for everybody to go, ooh, and then you get to put them all out. Some of these ladies' books are in their magazines are suggesting a mop and a bucket of sand next to your tree so that you can try and prevent the house from burning down when you do this.
Oh, dear. Well, and one of the things that drew our attention to this subject was an article that Living History Farm shared a few weeks ago on their Facebook page about a syndrome called Americanitis. And, you know, of course, during this holiday time, a lot of people get really, really stressed out. There's too much to do. It's too expensive. It's hard to really find the joy in the season when you're really busy all the time. We think about this as a modern problem, but it's something that people started complaining about almost as soon as they started celebrating Christmas, isn't it, Janet?
It's that industrialization and commercialization pressure. The ad that we were talking about where you're going to feel guilty if you don't remember all of these people in your presence, that creates a lot of stress for people. Very commonly, people will tell our interpreters in our 1850 cabin, oh, it must have been so much simpler back then. Well, they had all sorts of stressors. They're trying to feed their family. They're trying to keep them warm. And suddenly they're getting in the newspaper this whole new level of guilt of, okay, you're doing well. Now you need to give presents to everybody. So there's lots of stresses that come up with that. And there were, we often complain about how many parties we have to go to. By the 1870s, you see lists of the Methodist ladies are having their Christmas fair, and there's this party and that party. So you already have all of that stress to add in there. And it really depended on your family, how many of them you tried to get to, because then we also see farmers who in their diary on that day said, yep, I went to town to sell cattle, and that was it. So there's lots of levels of it. But that pressure of suddenly you can now afford mass-produced goods is pushing that stress out into the market.
And Bruce, earlier you were talking about how when Charles Dickens published A Christmas Carol, the idea that Bob Cratchit wanted to have the day off, the entire day off for Christmas, was kind of a new idea. As Christmas was celebrated around the world and in the United States, when did it become a time where people didn't have to work?
Well, I think quite quickly after the colonial era, it pretty much became a time off work. The further you got into the new nation and into the 1800s, it's really along with Christmas coming rushing back. That's when it happened. Can I mention something about your earlier discussion? It's not just commercialization. The other thing that's familiar early on is complaints about people having to work at bad times, especially in the retail industry. Mm-hmm. So just like we have problems with Thanksgiving, people have to work on Thanksgiving Day. Isn't that horrible? There are all kinds of protests in the 1900s about people shouldn't have to work in the evening, even though the retailers wanted to stay open in the evening. As this advances, it causes social ripples. And even the obligations to give to your employers or your enemies, there was an organization called the Society for the Prevention of Useless Giving, SPUG.
Now, how did that ever go away? Yeah. We need that.
We got to bring that back. That's right. So there has been, as all this, all these great trends develop, there has been kind of a line of protest that's almost always accompanied it to some extent.
Well, of course, now the holiday shopping season, well, it starts maybe the day after October, maybe earlier. But the day after Thanksgiving, of course, is known as Black Friday, and that's the day when the retailers are supposed to get in the black.
Right.
When did that start, Bruce? Do you know?
Well, you know, I just wrote a little piece on Black Friday, and the first use of the term wasn't the meaning that we now use. The first use was in the 1950s when employers wanted people to come to work, and they wouldn't. They would all call in sick. So it was called Friday after Thanksgiving-itis. And so employers started calling it Black Friday because they couldn't get workers to come. They all went shopping. And then I think the term started to catch on even more in Philadelphia, and police would use it because of crowd control problems. In other words, it was a negative term. Black Friday because they couldn't control the crowds, and it was made worse in Philadelphia because they had an Army-Navy football game the same weekend. And then later, I think merchant interests said, this doesn't help our sales. We need to change the meaning. And so then the meaning was changed. But this is in the – using Black Friday in that terminology now is – it started in the 1980s. It became national in the 1990s. It's quite recent.
Oh, wow. Well, and let's talk about another element of Christmas that gives a lot of people stress and also brings a lot of joy. Christmas cards. Janet, when did we start to see people sending Christmas cards to each other?
It's a British tradition before the American Civil War time. But you start to see it in America with the just after the Civil War in the later 1870s as chromolithography becomes cheap, being able to make beautiful colored cards. And you can kind of blame that on Louis Prang. His businesses start to sell some of the first really pretty cards that make that trend really popular. So by the 1880s, it's something that if you can't buy something for your friends, this is another way to gift to them.
Bruce, as you have studied the traditions of Christmas and learned about how it became the holiday that it is today, of course, it continues to change and morph. Are there things about our Christmas celebration today that you think are going to be a significant part of Christmas in the future?
Well, I'm just interested in the I'm very interested in the complications. If we have a family-centered celebration, and then we know how complicated families have become with divorce rates, with single parents, with blended families. One of the trends I'm noticing that I can't predict the future very well, but it's interesting to watch is how many people have multiple Christmases.
Yeah.
So they have one for each side of the family, or the only time the extended family can get together is really 2 weeks after Christmas. I mean, all of these alternative celebrations, I think people have been very creative in trying to remake it in ways that work for them. I think that's a huge development now, and it's interesting to see how that will work itself out further.
Well, and it is maintaining that idea that Charles Dickens started, that it's a time to gather with family.
Yes. I mean, that even for persons for whom it's not about religious meetings, it's not other things, if you're not able to be with other people at Christmas, there is this sense of regret, I think. And so single people in town where they can't get together with other kinds of family do everything they can to have a gathering of their own. We need community at this time because of everything else that's happening around us.
And I see that even in the Victorian era, I have a little piece out of the Winterset paper in 1874 listing one of the wealthy families in town that actually had their own family Christmas tree that year. And it lists all of the nieces and nephews and sons who were able to come to this party except one. And they list him by name. And I thought, oh, what kind of a guilt trip is that, that this poor man didn't make the party?
Did my grandmother write that? Goodness.
It's like, okay, it made it to the paper. So I think that guilt already existed then. And so we're much more like the Victorians than we want to admit.
Yeah.
Well, as we have just 1 minute left, I mean, Janet, when you think about how the pioneers celebrated Christmas and the settlers, the early towns in Iowa, is there a piece of that that you try to incorporate into your own celebrations?
I think being able to pull as many traditions that mean something to your own family is what I take out of it. When you see the diary entries of what they miss or what they do, it's something that is special for them at that time. And so now if your own family traditions are maybe 5 years old, that's okay. It doesn't have to be 500 years old, as long as it meant something to you to be together.
Well, Janet, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Janet Claire Dennis, Director of Interpretation at Living History Farms. And Bruce, with all that you have discovered about the history of Christmas, how do you carry that with you into your celebration?
Well, I think I am especially affected by how hectic it becomes and we feel overwhelmed. I think my message to myself and to most people to whom I speak is, this is fairly simple. I shouldn't just go on autopilot when the Christmas season approaches. What I should do is reflect on the past few years and see what in those past few years did I find most fulfilling and what burdened me. And you know, the solution might be, do more of what was fulfilling and just quit doing some of the things that burdened me. I'm trying to do that more every year.
Bruce, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Bruce Forbes is a professor of religious studies at Morningside College in Sioux City. He's also the author of Christmas, A Candid History, and recently published America's Favorite Holidays, A Candid History. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
A special one for you. Merry Christmas, darling. We're apart, that's true. But I can dream, and in my dreams, I'm